Perpetual Motion Machine for Thursday, June 15, 2017. I'm your host, Dennis Schaefer. Tonight, we have an interview with renowned particle physicist, Brian Cox. I have an interview that was done in Australia with Brian Cox, and here's part one of that interview. And the host was Alan Duffy.
The students of Australia asked some amazing questions about the universe and physics. So Professor Brian Cox has popped into the Australia's Science Channel offices to have a shot at answering them. Brian, great to see you.
Good to be here.
So our first question comes from Alex in Perth, a lovely question about light moving through space and the idea that how can light be both a particle and a wave?
It's a brilliant question, that. I mean, that's the fundamental question that we were forced to ask in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So, and actually before then, in fact, go back all the way back to 1905, in fact, and Einstein. So experimentally, we find that in order to describe the way that particles, all particles, behave, then you can consider them as particles. So point-like things. So when they interact in particle physics, what do we see? We see essentially a game of billiards, right? We see things with mass, or indeed with no mass, in the case of photons, little particles bouncing off each other, like a...
We have a lot of fruit.
Like that. That's what we see. However, in order to describe where they're going to go, so you can ask the question, I've got a particle here, where's it going to be at some later time, which is, I suppose, the fundamental question you ask in physics or dynamics, where's it going to go? Then you find that you have to... The mathematics that describes where it's going to go is very wave-like, and so particles behave like waves in the sense that if you want to calculate where they're going to go, you end up with things you get with waves, properties of waves. So, for example, with a wave, you can get what's called interference, which means that the peak of one wave lines up with the trough of the other one, and the waves cancel out. And you get that with the way that particles move around. So I suppose the best thing to say is that my prejudice, and this is a prejudice, actually, my feeling is that particles are particles, and that's the way that particle physicists tend to think about them. But the way they move is not like the sort of particles we can imagine. So they don't just, if you hit them, if you bang the two together, you go boing, and that one goes off, and you can calculate it all using simple. You can calculate it, but the maths you use is quite wavy and wave-like. So that's the way I look at it. I mean, how do you look at that? I mean, because it's kind of almost astronomer.
We use waves for everything. Yeah. Everything is wave for us.
So, yeah, I mean, I should say that if you're an astronomer, or if you're building an antenna to contact a spacecraft on the edge of the solar system, like Voyager or something like that, then you use what's called Maxwell's equations, which are wave equations, and light is a wave in the electric and magnetic fields, and that's what you do. But if you're a particle physicist and you want to, for example, I once did some measurements on a particle accelerator on photon-photon collisions. So that's particles of light bouncing off each other. And they'll do that at very high energies, right? So that they can scatter. And so then you're really thinking of a photon as a particle because it bounces off other photons, right? So that's not a very wavy thing to do in that sense. So I suppose it's kind of what you call horses for courses in the way that you can think about light.
Use whichever is appropriate, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Sion in Brisbane. One wants to know if there's any gravity in space, and in particular, what would happen if he dropped his toy monkey in space?
So there is gravity in space. It's a common sort of misconception, actually. You think you see the space station, and you see the astronauts in it floating around, and you think gravity's gone away. No, actually, they're only about, what is it, about 200 miles or so from the Earth's surface?
Maybe
200 kilometres or something, maybe less. So it's only a few hundred kilometres up, and gravity, as we know from Newton's law, drops off as the square of the distance, in this case from the centre of the Earth, pretty much. So you can imagine that you go away to the surface of the Earth and then go a little bit further to the height of the space station. So there's very little difference. So there's very little change in the force of gravity. If you're thinking like Newton, what's happening is that everybody's falling. and everybody's falling at the same rate. And that's why it looks like there's no gravity. And that in Newton's law, back in 1687, that was kind of a coincidence. It was known, but the what you're seeing in Newton's language is that something called, so you'll all know, everyone will know, F equals MA. You learn that, your physics students, you'll learn it. So you've got a mass there, which says how hard it is to accelerate something. So you exert a force on something, and how fast does it accelerate? If it's more massive, it accelerates more slowly. You can think of that as a definition of the mass, actually. Force divided by acceleration equals some number. So what is it? That's called the inertial mass. And then there's the mass in Newton's law, which you will also know, which is F equals G, mass of the Earth, let's say, mass of astronaut, divided by the distance between them squared, centre of the Earth to the astronaut, centre of the astronaut, actually. And so there's that one. And so what happens when you calculate how things move under gravity is that the masses cancel out of the thing that's doing the falling in this picture, and so everything falls at the same rate in the gravitational field. But, and this goes... gone to Einstein, and it's a radically different picture. So Einstein says that what gravity is really is what you might call a fictitious force. It's not a real force in a sense. It's to do with the fact that mass and energy, something like the Earth, curves the fabric of the universe itself. So, and what you see is things moving in a curved fabric. And so that's, then it's not surprising that things move in the same way, because they're moving through the same fabric in that sense.
I nicked a fabric, if you wanted to show that.
Oh, there's a fabric.
Fabric.
So this is...
We use one of the plums.
We could be... Oh, yeah. So there we go. So Einstein would say that there's this nice space and time, actually. Space-time, it's a fabric. And if you put something like the Earth in it, it will warp and bend the fabric. And then things move in straight lines through this curved fabric. So there really is gravity in space, if you can see. If what you're really saying is that you're really asking, in Einstein's language, is space and time mixed up together? Is it curved? Is there some residual kind of curvature? And then this actually goes out in principle, this curvature, all the way, I suppose, to the edge of the universe, ultimately. But you won't feel it when you're a long way away. So all the space is curved by everything, so there's always gravity there. And that as a consequence, by the way, you think about it, that light should be bent by gravity as well. And it is. So light curves around stars. We have a phenomenon called gravitational lensing, which is one of the ways we measure the masses of galaxy clusters. And that's because the galaxy is bending the space and time, and the light goes through the curved space and curves. It's like looking at the universe through a wine glass. And they're seeing a distorted image. So if you drop, and the final answer to your question, if you drop your monkey, if you put it in space, it will go in a straight line through the curved space-time, as will everything. And so it will follow, it's called a geodesic. So your monkey will follow a geodesic through space and time.
Awesome.
So, it's true, isn't it?
It's true, absolutely true. That is one impressive toy monkey. Nikita in Sydney.
It'd be impressive if it didn't. Because if it didn't follow...
A really freaky monkey.
Then we would have, it would be the only thing in the universe that didn't do that. So.
Okay, well, hopefully his toy monkey will make it a safe orbit. And,
we have to reassess our theory.
That you just heard was Brian Cox, the author, co-author of the book Universal, A Guide to the Cosmos. One thing I failed to mention in that interview was that Alan Duffy, the host, was asking kids questions of Brian Cox. And coming up is the second part of that.
Leo in Adelaide asks, and I love this question, since the universe contains billions of stars, why is the night sky dark?
Yeah, I know why you love this question, because it's a classic. The people thought about it for centuries, and it's called Olbers' paradox. Dutch astronomer, he's Dutch, wasn't he, Olbers?
I think so, yeah.
And I'm trying to remember when it was now. Was it 1500 or 1600? Do you remember?
Some reason I feel it was 1600.
1600, yeah. Something, it was a long time ago, 500, 400 or 500 years ago, at least. And plus or minus.
There's always an error associated with these measurements.
And, historians would say there shouldn't be an error with the life of Olbers, but there won't be, But you can look that up. That's homework. But anyway, but he thought about this and he came to the conclusion that if the universe had been around forever and it was infinite in extent, then you could look up and every line of sight would end on a star. And if there'd been enough time, then the light would have travelled at time to come to us. And because every line of sight would end on a star, you would see the sky ablaze with light. And it isn't. And that was enough for Olbers, I think, to say that the universe was... I think he concluded it had a beginning from that, I think. Or I suppose he could have concluded that it wasn't infinite in extent.
Yeah.
But you can... I'm not sure which way you could argue either way.
Either way.
But the point is that that's interesting. And you could say, well, but... Okay, so I can see that in an infinite universe with an infinite number of stars and they're all over the place, then every line of sight ends on a star. You could say, what if there's dust around? And Olbers thought about that and said, yeah, but then the light will heat it up. So if it had been around for an infinite amount of time, then dust will glow as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a very beautiful question. So the answer today in modern language is that we live in an expanding universe that's 13.8 billion years old. And that's ultimately why the sky isn't absolutely ablaze with light, because the universe is expanding.
There's a beautiful analogy where you have a forest and you'll have individual trees, and if that forest is deep enough, if you can see far enough back, you can no longer see through the forest, and it blocks every line of sight.
Yeah.
I did love that question.
Dust does obscure the galaxy, and you're very lucky here in Australia because you can see that, because you can see Sagittarius right towards the centre of the Milky Way. So you should see these bright, you know, the Milky Way is a bright sort of streak across the sky, but at the centre it's black. You can't see. And that's not because there aren't billions of stars. It's the brightest bit of the Milky Way, but there's dust in the way, and that dust hasn't heated up to glow. It does glow, but not in the wavelength you can see. It's not hot enough for you to see with the naked eye. So you'll see the dust cloud. So go out tonight. It'll be, I was going to say, on a clear night. It's always clear in Australia, as far as I can tell.
It's pretty good.
Never rains. Yeah. But so go out and have a look at the centre of the galaxy, the constellation of Sagittarius, and you'll see the Milky Way blotted out. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's there's a constellation in the Aboriginal sky. If you look up and you look at the way that they name the constellations and legends, that's called the Emu, and the dust is a part of the constellation. And that's a very beautiful thing, because we tend to, the constellations that were developed in Europe and those places, it's always the stars. But in the Aboriginal tradition, the dust forms a part of the Emu.
Thomas from Melbourne wants to know, when the sun runs out of hydrogen fuel, what will happen to Earth and the surrounding planets? And will the Earth become a rogue planet?
Of all the questions we've been asked, this is the one which the answer is known. It's one of the been great questions. So we know very well what's going to happen. So the sun runs out of hydrogen. Before then, actually, in about a billion and a half years, or a little bit less, the sun's gradually brightening, and it will brighten to the point where life on Earth becomes essentially impossible on the surface. Certainly, unless there's some quite radical adaptation, the water tends to boil away. So you could imagine life subsurface, perhaps, but it becomes essentially uninhabitable, certainly for us, in about 1.3 billion years. So the sun's brightening, and it runs out of its fuel in about 5 billion years, and starts in the core and starts swelling up, and it turns into what's called a red giant. But it also, so it swells up, and just very naively you could say, well, it's going to swell, it's certainly going to go past Mercury and engulf it, probably Venus and engulf it. Earth is kind of on the edge, so it might come out to the position of the Earth today, but it also loses mass as it does it, and the radius of the Earth's orbit is proportional to the mass of the sun. You decrease the mass of the sun, you increase the radius of the Earth's orbit. So you can think of it as the gravitational pull is less, if you want. So the Earth drifts out as the sun loses mass. So most of the models that I'm aware of say that the Earth survives that, because it goes away from the sun. It kind of, the sun sort of chases it away, because the sun's getting bigger but losing mass out into space. So the Earth goes out. So, I mean, it's not going to be a very nice place. It will have ceased to be a nice place long before that.
Yeah.
But so we think it'll stay in orbit, and it won't become a rogue planet because it will stay in orbit. The sun, I think the sun loses about half its mass ultimately, I think, and then collapses into a white dwarf star. Yeah. So it'll still be there with about half the mass that it has today, and the Earth will most likely be still in orbit around it. However, you've also got to consider the fact that the Andromeda galaxy is going to hit us before then. So whether or not that sort of disrupts things a bit is a good question. There'll certainly be a few more stars whizzing by.
Yeah.
How close they come to the solar system is anybody's guess. Probably not that close, but close enough to disrupt the orbits of planets. I don't know. Maybe the outer planets.
Definitely would kick up a few comets in the Oort cloud. It's going to make for a very entertaining night sky.
Yeah, it'll be great. I mean, the trouble is we'll have had to move before then, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
But we could hop out to Pluto or something.
Yeah, with its magnetic field.
Oh, I don't think
sorry, not magnetic field, sorry.
But geological activity.
Geological activity. Final question is for me. What is the most amazing thing that you've learnt in your career?
It's a great question, because there are things I've, probably things I've discovered, which are, you know, of virtually no interest to anyone, in the sense but are wonderful things. The thing about, and you'll know this, the thing about being a researcher, and I know that many of you watching will want to be researchers, is that there's always a time when you, especially when you do a PhD, where you know something that nobody else knows. There has to be, so by definition, actually, because your PhD has got to be an addition to knowledge. It's got to be new knowledge. So you generate the knowledge, and it might be about anything. And in my case, it's been about something called diffractive scattering, where particles kind of glance off each other and exploring that. But there's always a point when you make a graph or you do something, or you're looking at some data, and you find out something and you see it for the first time, and nobody else knows that. And nobody else may care to know, you know, because most people, you know, most science is a very incremental subject, but someone in the future might build on the little bit you've done, and it might lead to something wonderful. Or if you're lucky, then it's mainly luck, you might make this big discovery that, you know, the universe is accelerating its expansion, or you might discover the pear-shaped nucleus, so you might do so, you know, so... So that's it. So I would say that it's one of those little things that I knew before anyone else knew. Usually late at night in front of a computer, if you're a particle physicist, and you make a plot and you go, oh yeah, nobody's seen that.
That's cool. All right, Brian, thank you so much for answering our questions. It's always a pleasure having you on Australia Science Channel.
Pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next time.
Yeah, that again was Brian Cox. He was doing an interview from Kids Questions on the Australia's Science Channel. This has been another edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine, brought to you by the Madison Science Radio Collective. We had Brian Cox as a guest from the Australia's Science Channel. And I'm your host, Dennis Schaefer. Join us again next week for the next episode of the Perpetual Notion Machine.